in Islamic society, shame and honour of our key values. I have to say that I started wondering at one of the chapel services here, well, it must have been the last one, integrity and integrity was considered, I think, the prime virtue or the prime quality. But I wondered how much that would be true in Eastern society or in Muslim society. Islam allows a person to, a man, to lie on three occasions. One is if there's danger in battle or he's under pressure. He can lie to his wife. So in time of war he can lie and for his safety, and he can lie to his wife if the truth would upset the sort of relationships in the homes. And there is a third category, so integrity wouldn't quite fit that. And the whole emphasis on shame and honour and shame and chastity. You've probably heard of shame-orientated societies and guilt-orientated societies. So guilt-orientated societies, maybe integrity would be a major, if not the major, item. Perhaps it could be. But in shame-orientated societies, to protect honour, it might be something different. Just a thought. I suppose that's the excursion I went on during prayers. In chapel. Anyway, shame on you. In Afghanistan, saving and maintaining one's honour or face is one of the most powerful determinators of people's ethics. Whatever else may happen, one has to avoid shame. Shame or the lack of it is a kind of morality in its own right. In order not to lose face, people perform both extraordinary deeds of valour and are prepared to lie, deceive, kill, or even betray their own family members. So should one do away with shame? No, for that leads only to debauchery. Is this not one of the curses of Western civilization that it has lost any sense of shame? One famous Persian poet writes, "Shame is the fruit of reason and the root of religion. If you have no shame, you have no faith. Shame thus not only covers up inner flaws of character, but it is exalted as the foundation of morality and religious faith. Yet to cover up one's inner faults produces at the best hypocrisy and at the worst treachery and bloodshed. Shame, or the fear of it, ensnares people to a slavish obedience of cultural norms. To break the code of honour, or even worse, to change one's religion, one's faith, is the greatest shame of all. And so the freedom of the individual is suppressed and paralysed by an all-pervading fear. Out of fear of being ashamed, or of being shamed, or being accused for not being manly enough, one will atone by killing others. This activates a bloody cycle of revenge killings. For the male clan members of those killed are obliged, by the same code, to redeem the family's honour by killing their enemy's relatives. So the blood of the innocent is shed to prove the honour of another." And I bear testimony to this from my 15 years near to the Afghan border of Pakistan, in Pakistan near to the Afghan border, that these tribes, Pashtun tribes, Bhutan tribes, kept these things going, sometimes these feuds, for 100 years or so. The Bible teaches that shame and covering up is one of the results of the tragedy of fallen humanity. In the fall, there is a direct link between sin, guilt, and shame, and the desire to cover up. Christ, the second Adam, died naked on the cross, shamed and dishonoured. In so doing, he broke the curse of shame, fear and guilt. He provided the covering, which not only hides our flaws, but removes them. So when we think about female circumcision, we should think about it in the context of the culture and the religious approach and thinking. The idea that chastity and honour, the honour of the family, is in the chastity of its women. So all this is behind the reinforcement that Islam seems to give to female circumcision in at least 100 million women of its Muslim of the world. So let's turn back to this paper, which I seem also to have misplaced. Do you have the copy? No. Sorry, I have another copy, but I can't find it at the moment. Thank you very much. So this is World Wide Web, and we have noted that the date in which our friend dipped into it is 23rd. It was the 23rd of June 1998. These reports get updated, but it's good if you're going to take something off, please date it. Now, when, where, and why is it done? I think we've explored who does it and where and why. We've noted the large numbers who are involved, and we've noted the countries. Just to give another perspective, the operation is forced on approximately 6,000 girls per day worldwide. Since FGM is practiced when the girls are young, they are unable to give their informed consent. The justification for the operation appears to be largely grounded in a desire to terminate or reduce feelings of sexual arousal in women, so that they will be much less likely to engage in premarital intercourse or adultery. Uncircumcised women in a Muslim country where circumcision is normally performed have difficulty finding a marriage partner. Men typically prefer a circumcised wife because they are considered more likely to be faithful. And then there are other claims in support of FGM, which don't make too much sense to us, but here they are. The clitoris is dangerous and must be removed for health reasons. Some believe it's a poisonous organ that can cause a man to sicken and die if it's contacted by a man's penis. Others believe that men can become impotent by contacting the clitoris, or that a baby will be hydrocephalic, born with an excess of cranial fluid, if its head contacts the clitoris during birth. Some believe that the milk of the mother will become poisonous if her clitoris touches the baby. Bad genital odours can only be eliminated by removing the clitoris and the labia minora. FGM prevents vaginal cancer. An unmodified clitoris can lead to masturbation or lesbianism. FGM prevents nervousness from developing in girls and women. FGM prevents the face from turning yellow. FGM makes a woman's face more beautiful. FGM, if not done, older men may not be able to match their wives' sex drive and may have to resort to illegal stimulating drugs, like the new one, I suppose. An intact clitoris generates sexual arousal in women and can cause neuroses if repressed. These claims appear to have little support outside of countries where FGM is common. It is important to realise that male circumcision is done for health and religious reasons and does not interfere with a man's enjoyment of sexual acts. FGM, on the other hand, reduces or eliminates a woman's ability to gain pleasure from sexual activities. It is used to attempt to control women's sexual desires. The fear of AIDS has been used by both sides in this issue, in discussing this issue. And Sheikh Badri stated in 1997 in June, those who are not circumcised get AIDS easily. But opponents to the practice sometimes claim that AIDS is spread by unhygienic practices during the procedure itself. And then there's a debate among Muslims, another heading here, about the whole matter. FGM has probably been performed at least 1,400 years. The Bible is silent on the subject. The Sunnah, the words and actions of the Prophet, contain a number of references to female circumcision. So that's the hadith, really, the words and actions of the Prophet, some references. A discussion is reported between Muhammad and Habiba, a woman who performed infibulation on slaves. She said that she would continue the procedure unless it is forbidden and you order me to stop. He, and Muhammad, replied, yes, it is allowed. Come closer so I can teach you. If you cut, do not overdo it, because it brings more radiance to the face and it's more pleasant for the husband. Muhammad is recorded as speaking of the Sunnah circumcision to the Ansar's wives, saying, I think the Ansar's were the helpers. His name is Helper, capital H, Ansar. Well, these their wives, saying, cut slightly without exaggeration, more or less the same thing. So many Muslims see passages in the Quran which, by implication, oppose FGM. And these are the arguments. God apparently created the clitoris for the sole purpose of generating pleasure. It has no other purpose. Thus God must approve of its presence. And if so, it should not be removed or reduced in size or function. Another argument, the Quran promotes the concept of a wife being given pleasure by her husband during sexual intercourse. Mutilated genitalia reduce or eliminate a woman's pleasure during the act. And then another, this is a very interesting comment. This is Naval El-Sadawi, who's one of the feminists, famous Egyptian feminist, and we'll meet her later in the day, I think, in her capacity as a feminist. She wrote novels, and she wrote, she was a doctor and became Minister of Health in Egypt and then got sacked because of her probably rather radical views. But she found one way to communicate on the subject of women's issues and even on this issue of female genitation, female mutilation, by writing novels. So in her characters, she was able to communicate truth in that way. And probably if she'd confined herself to that way, she wouldn't have got sacked, maybe. But she was a doctor. She was Minister of Health, and she spoke her mind. So here's one. She herself was a victim of infibulation. And in one of her books, I remember reading the shock account of her experience. And that has made me think more and more about not just the mutilation of the body, which is one thing, but what does this do to a child between below nine, or what does it do right through life? What kind of psychological and psychiatric effects does it have? So she says, the importance given to virginity and an intact hymen in these societies is the reason why female circumcision still remains of very widespread practice, despite a growing tendency, especially in urban Egypt, to do away with it as something outdated and harmful. Behind circumcision lies the belief that by removing parts of girls' genitalia, sexual desire is minimized. This permits a female who has reached the dangerous age of puberty and adolescence to protect her virginity and therefore her honor with greater ease. Chastity was imposed on male attendants in the female harem by castration, which turned them into inoffensive eunuchs. Similarly, female circumcision is meant to preserve the chastity of young girls by reducing their desire for sexual intercourse. Muhammad Saeed Tantawi, head of the Al-Azhar Islamic Institute, has stated that the practice is un-Islamic, and one health minister of Egypt, Ismail Salem, pronounced the ban on FGM in July 1996, and this was upheld by a junior administrative court in Cairo. But Sheikh Yusuf Badri, a Muslim fundamentalist, took the health minister to court, and in 1997, in June, an Egyptian court overturned the country's ban on FGM. Eight Muslim scholars and doctors had testified that the ban exceeded the government's authority and violated the legal rights of the medical profession. Sheikh Yusuf Badri commented, "Female circumcision is Islamic. The court has said that the ban violated religious law. There's nothing which says circumcision is a crime, but the Egyptians came along and said that Islam is a crime." About 1997 in July, a German newspaper interviewed Sheikh Badri. He claimed that many Muslim women are pleased with this victory of Islam over its enemies. When it was pointed out to him that parents in Morocco and Algeria do not practice FGM, he replied that the clitoris in Egyptian girls was larger than in those countries and had to be cut back to normal size. He quoted a French study which showed that circumcised girls are less likely to catch AIDS, and in brackets here, perhaps because they're less likely to be sexually active. He believes that the United States is spreading misinformation on the health risks of FGM. Well, there's a bit more about how it's gone backwards and forwards in the Egyptian scene. Fatwas are published. There are published opinions by Muslim religious scholars, but they're not binding in law. But Muslim believers are expected to follow them. So some have given fatwas. But in January 1981, the great Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the most famous university of the Islamic world, stated that parents must follow the lessons of Muhammad and not listen to medical authorities, because the latter often change their minds. Parents must do their duties and have their daughters circumcised. And then the reaction of the Islamic world. The UN, the United Nations, has supported the right of member states to grant refugee status to women who fear being mutilated if they are returned to their country of origin. Canada has granted such status to women in this situation. A judge of the Canadian Federal Court declared it a cruel and barbaric practice. In 1994, CNN broadcast footage of the circumcision of a 10-year-old Egyptian girl by an unskilled practitioner. This program drew international attention to the operation, and a $500 million lawsuit was brought against CNN for allegedly damaging Egypt's reputation. It was rejected by the courts. In the West, the procedure is outlawed in Britain, Canada, France, Sweden, Switzerland, and the United States. A US federal bill, federal prohibition of female genitation, mutilation, of 1995, was passed in 1996. And then the Canadian Criminal Court protects children who are ordinary residents in Canada, either as citizens or landed migrants. It prevents them from being removed from the country and subjected to FGM. In the US and Canada, the very small percentage of Muslims who wish to continue the practice often find it impossible to find a doctor who will cooperate. The operation is often done in the home by the family. So here you see that the mindset has to be changed, doesn't it? So the doctors obviously do not cooperate, but the operation is often done in the home by the family. So here is a cultural thing reinforced by religion, and it's not easy to change. UN activity. In 1958, the Economic and Social Committee of the United Nations invited the World Health Organization to undertake a study of the persistence of customs involving ritual practices on girls and the measures in effect or planned to put an end to those practices. Well, that's the World Health Organization responded that the ritual practices in question, resulting from social and cultural conceptions, are not within the World Health Organization's jurisdiction. Subsequently, they changed their position, and in 1989, the Regional Committee of WHO for Africa passed a resolution urging participating governments to adopt appropriate policies and strategies in order to eradicate female circumcision and to forbid medicalization of female circumcision and to discourage health professionals from performing such surgery. And lastly, in 1980, UNICEF announced its anti-FGM program, and it's based on the belief that the best way to handle the problem is to trigger awareness through education of the public, members of the medical profession, and practitioners of traditional health care with the help of local collectives and their leaders. Personally, I think there's more needed because it's so deep into the culture. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is ambiguous about FGM. On the other hand, Article 24, paragraph 3 states, "State parties shall take all effective and appropriate measures with a view to abolishing traditional practices prejudicial to the health of children." But Article 29, paragraph 1 calls for the development of respect for the child's parents, his or her own cultural identity, language and values, for the national values of the country in which the child is living, the country from which he or may originate, and for civilizations different from his or her own. Well, we're very grateful for all your work on the internet, Tina, and this is helpful, very helpful information for us. And I think that we've seen the issues. The issues are: here's a practice reinforced by Islam. If it's not actively reinforced, it is permitted, and there is not an active program to change that we can see. And so this is something very deep, and even the measures that we've just read may not be adequate. It needs loving servants of God to show God's compassion and to work closely with people in these situations, as does this doctor that I heard lecture who has a clinic for Somalis in northwest London. And I think she was going to the deepest areas, and she was relating to the family, not just to the woman. She is relating to the culture and to the language. She was listening, she was not looking just as a doctor, but she was relating as a full person with these people who are free, certainly in Britain, and by law protected from exercising or being pressured by family, extended family, or anyone else into continuing such practices. So by law, but it doesn't change. She still has many coming some child will be bought who's suffering from the immediate effects of this operation done privately, done in the home, because it's illegal in Britain. But the fact that it's still going on, I think that she is dealing with the whole question, which is many-sided. But it's a slow and costly way. I think that there are many Muslim doctors who are committed to certainly not practicing this in any culture, whether Islamic or in countries where Muslims are in minority. But But it needs more than just the refusal on the physical side. It is a problem in relating to cultures and to whole extended families, to whole countries, if you take Sudan and Somalia.